chapter 29 of Sirach. He that shows mercy will lend to his neighbor, and he that strengthens him with his hand keeps the commandments. Lend to your neighbor in the time of his need, and in turn repay your neighbor promptly. So if he lends you stuff, be sure you repay pay him back promptly. Confirm your word and keep faith with him, and on every occasion you will find what you need. Many persons regard a loan as a windfall and cause trouble to those who help them. A man will kiss another's hand until he gets a loan, and then will lower his voice in speaking of his neighbor's money. But at the time of repayment, he will delay and will pay in words of concern and will find fault with the time. If the lender exert pressure, he will hardly get back half and will regard that as a windfall. If he does not, the borrower has robbed him of his money, and he has needlessly made him his enemy. He will repay him with curses and reproaches, and instead of glory will repay him with dishonor. Because of such wickedness, therefore, many have refused to lend. They have been afraid of being defrauded needlessly. Nevertheless, be patient with a man in humble circumstances, and do not make him wait for your alms. Help a poor man for the commandment's sake, and because of his need, do not send him away empty. Lose your silver for the sake of a brother or a friend, and do not let it rust under a stone and be lost. Lay up your treasure according to the commandments of the Most High, and it will profit you more than gold. Of course, Jesus tells us that same thing in the gospel where he says, you know, gather up treasure in heaven, not worry about treasure on earth. That same idea. Store up almsgiving in your treasury, and it will rescue you from all affliction. More than a mighty shield and more than a heavy spear, it will fight on your behalf against your enemy. A good man will be surety for his neighbor, but a man who has lost his sense of shame will fail him. Surety, of course, means when you co-sign a note for somebody. You guarantee the payment. Okay. Do not forget all the kindness of your surety, for he has given his life for you. And that one that gave his life for us, of course, is Jesus. So that's a direct reference there. A sinner will overthrow the prosperity of his surety, and one who does not feel grateful will abandon his rescuer. But being a surety has ruined many men who were prosperous and has shaken them like a wave of the sea. It has driven men of power into exile, and they have wandered among foreign nations. The sinner who has fallen into suretyship and pursues gain will fall into lawsuits. Assist your neighbor according to your ability, but take heed to yourself, lest you fall. The essentials for life are water and bread, and clothing and a house to cover one's nakedness. Better is the life of a poor man under the shelter of his roof than sumptuous food in another man's house. Be content with little or much. Be happy with what you have, in other words. It is a miserable life to go from house to house, and where you are a stranger, you may not open your mouth. You will pay the host and provide drink without being thanked, and besides this, you will hear bitter words. Come here, stranger, prepare the table. If you have anything at hand, let me have it to eat. Give place, stranger, to an honored person. My brother has come to stay with me. I need my house. These things are hard to bear for a man who has feelings. Scolding and lodging, and the reproach of the money lender. So, if you do it right, it comes out right for you and for them. But if you are not giving alms in the right way, it just leads to all kinds of other troubles. So use prudence, use judgment.
I'm thinking of Jesus. He didn't give us a loan. He gave us everything. And that spirit should just make us be as generous as we can.
Yeah.
You know, and
But again, you got to use good judgment and prudence.
Right, yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah.
And then he gets into bringing up children. Chapter 30.
Oh, dear.
He who loves his son will whip him often. A lot of these ideas in here.
A little old,
a little different from what we do today. But yeah. But it does bring up the question, you know, is a good spanking at the proper time for the good reason a good thing to do?
Yeah.
And I have no problem with that.
Right.
You know, I really don't.
Yeah.
This idea of never spanking a child oftentimes leads to juvenile delinquency.
Yeah, they need discipline.
They need discipline. And that's the whole point of this whole section here, that we need to discipline our children just like God disciplines us.
Mm.
And he gives examples of how he disciplined the Israelites. He who loves his son will whip him often in order that he may rejoice at the way he turns out. He who disciplines his son will profit by him. In fact, Sunday's reading had something very similar to that.
Yeah.
In the readings, he talked about God's discipline and stuff like this. He who disciplines his son will profit by him and will boast of him among acquaintances. He who teaches his son will make his enemies envious and will glory in him in the presence of friends. The father may die, and yet he is not dead, for he has left behind him one like himself. That's kind of an... He doesn't ever talk about the afterlife throughout this whole book.
And they didn't necessarily believe in an afterlife.
Well, the Sadducees didn't.
Right.
Yeah, the Pharisees did.
Yeah.
And I would think that Ben Sirach does too. But the afterlife was never revealed to them.
Right.
And that's why the gospel was so important, because Jesus began to tell us, well, what is the kingdom of heaven like? You know, what is the kingdom of heaven like? And because they really don't know.
Right.
And so he doesn't really say much about it. By the way, Ben Sirach was a scribe.
Oh, okay.
So that's why he writes so well and everything.
Because
most people back then were kind of illiterate. So the father may die, and yet he is not dead, for he has left behind him one like himself. While alive, he saw and rejoiced. When he died, he was not grieved. He has left behind him an avenger against his enemies and one to repay the kindness of his friends. So the son picks up where the father left off in leading a good life. He who spoils his son will bind up his wounds, and his feelings will be troubled at every cry. A horse that is untamed turns out to be stubborn, and a son unrestrained turns out to be willful. Pamper a child, and he will frighten you. Play with him, and he will give you grief. So don't ever play with your children.
Oh, dear.
Some of these things really
out of context.
It takes. That's right. That's
people
right.
Do that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Do not laugh with him, lest you have sorrow with him, and in the end you will gnash your teeth. Give him no authority in his youth, and do not ignore his errors. Bow down his neck in his youth, and beat his sides while he is young, lest he become stubborn and disobey you, and you have sorrow of soul from him. Discipline your son and take pains with him, that you may not be offended by his shamelessness. So, I think if he was around today, he'd be arrested for child abuse or something.
For sure.
You know? But I'm not sure I agree with everything he says here. But that was back then.
Good
that was
thinking.
The good thinking back then, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I played with my kids.
Oh, good.
I still play with my kids, and they're 30 years old. You know, so.
I'm sure you're laughing with them, right?
Yeah. Yep. So health and happiness. So I'll switch section 14. Verse 14. There's a little note here on 14. It says, these counsels from 30:14 to 30:25. These counsels have an Epicurean or hedonistic ring to them, though the writer's attack on idols and his reference to the Lord in this context does raise the tone somewhat. This religious sense does help to get across a valuable lesson. Physical and spiritual health are things of great value. The church picks up on this teaching, setting it in the overall context of salvation. We can see this, for example, in a prayer from the liturgy, from the collect prayer of the Common of the Blessed Virgin Mary, which says, Lord God, give to your people the joy of continual health in mind and body. With the prayers of the Virgin Mary to help us, guide us through the sorrows of this life to eternal happiness in the life to come. So he's talking about how the importance of being happy and staying healthy. Of course, God is always the source of both of those. Okay, better off is a poor man who is well and strong in constitution than a rich man who is severely afflicted in body. Health and soundness are better than all gold, and a robust body than countless riches. There is no wealth better than health of body. There is no gladness above joy of heart. Death is better than a miserable life, and eternal rest than chronic sickness. You got to watch when you see those kind of things, because some people will use that maxim as a rationale for committing suicide. You know, so you got to watch that and just take it in the right sense. Good things poured out upon a mouth that is closed are like offering of food placed upon a grave. Of what use to an idol is an offering of fruit? Now, the mouth that is closed, of course, is the idol that we're talking about here. Okay. Sometimes he swings into talk about idolatry. You don't realize that's what he's doing until later, a few lines later, then you realize he's talking about idols, not people. Of what use to an idol is an offering of fruit, for it can neither eat nor smell? So is he who is afflicted by the Lord. He sees with his eyes and groans, like a eunuch who embraces a maiden and groans.
We never knew.
Let's not go there.
He's very graphic in his examples. Do not give yourself over to sorrow, and do not afflict yourself deliberately. Gladness of heart is the life of a man, and the rejoicing of a man is length of days. Delight your soul and comfort your heart, and remove sorrow far from you, for sorrow has destroyed many, and there is no profit in it. Jealousy and anger shorten life. Those are two of the tools that Satan uses against us all the time. Jealousy, anger, anxiety, those kind of things. He's always using those things to take us away from God. And so on. So jealousy and anger shorten life, and anxiety brings on old age too soon. A man of cheerful and good heart will give heed to the food he eats. So then we get to chapter 31, which is on the temptation of riches. So again, it's the idea that there's nothing wrong with being rich, but you can't get obsessed with being rich. You can't make that your sole purpose in life. You know, you don't have to be the richest man in the world to be happy. And he's got a note here on 31:1-11. It says, a preoccupation with acquiring and increasing one's material possessions does not make for serenity or serve the interests of justice. It only leads to restlessness and anxiety and even ruin. Having more and more wealth does not make a person more free. On the contrary, in verse 8 says, blessed is the rich man who is found blameless and who does not go after gold. So in verse 8, the Hebrew text uses the term mammon when referring to wealth, translated here as gold. Our Lord uses the same word in the plural. You cannot serve God and mammon. That's in Matthew 6:24 and Luke 16:13. But he gives it a more radical meaning than Sirach does, because by personalizing the word and putting riches on the same level as God, he is implying that a person who pursues wealth in a single-minded way is making an idol of it.
Thank you. I read during the day.
Hello, Carol.
I'm sorry, I'm in the hospital.
Oh, okay. Hope you get better fast.
Thank you. Continue, I love this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Where did we leave off? Oh. We saw it in 31, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wakefulness over wealth wastes away one's flesh, and anxiety about it removes sleep. Wakeful anxiety prevents slumber, and a severe illness carries off sleep. The rich man toils as his wealth accumulates, and when he rests, he fills himself with his dainties. The poor man toils as his livelihood diminishes, and when he rests, he becomes needy. So the poor man works and works and works just to survive. Mm-hmm. If he stops working, then he becomes very needy. He who loves gold will not be justified, and he who pursues money will be led astray by it. Many have come to ruin because of gold, and their destruction has met them face to face. It is a stumbling block to those who are devoted to it, and every fool will be taken captive by it. Blessed is the rich man who is found blameless and who does not go after gold. Who is he? And we will call him blessed, for he has done wonderful things among his people. Who has been tested by it and been found perfect? Let it be for him a ground for boasting. Who has had the power to transgress and did not transgress, and to do evil and did not do it? His prosperity will be established, and the assembly will relate his acts of charity. So don't make money and wealth your sole object of life.
Yeah. I'm thinking of Jesus. He said, store up for yourself treasures in heaven.
That's right.
Right? Not
that's
all
right.
This stuff. Anything on earth, right?
Well, he also said, where your heart is, that's where your treasure is.
Yeah.
Where your treasure is, that's where your heart is.
Yeah.
So if you're fixated on gold, you're never going to get to heaven because you never think about God.
Yeah.
You know, it just becomes, you become so obsessed with acquiring wealth that you don't want to acquire holiness.
Mm.
And that's the only way you get to heaven.
Mm.
Right? So the next section starts in verse 12, temperance and good manners. He's got a note here on 31:12 through 32:13. He says, these are a long series of counsels about temperance and table manners, and brings to an end this section of practical applications. First, the writer deals with table manners, then moderation in eating and drinking, and finally advice for people who have to preside at banquets. Western readers will notice here basic rules of good manners that they have known since childhood. In fact, in early catechetical texts, fathers simply repeat some counsels taken from this passage. St. Gregory the Great applies Sirach 32:1 in an allegorical sense to people with positions of authority in the church, although what he has to say applies to anyone who has others in his charge. And his quote is that all pastors should strive without ceasing to humble their authority in external ways so that it does not stand in the way of contemplation or allow their souls to become complacent. So he's really putting prayer in the first place there. You don't want anything to get in the way of your prayer and your contemplation. For if authority is not exercised over the mind of the one who possesses it, then the soul may acquire a taste for power itself. How often do we see that happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, was a saying, power corrupts and absolute
so
power corrupts absolutely?
Absolutely.
Okay. It is so that a pastor's soul could not become filled with pride because of his power, that the wise man says, if they make you master of the feast, do not exalt yourself. So that's from St. Gregory the Great. So temperance and good manners. Are you seated at the table of a great man? Do not be greedy at it, and do not say, there is certainly much upon it. So you go to the table and you look at it and say, wow, look at all that good food.
Like a buffet, right?
Like it, right? Say, don't say that. Don't be... They'll be doing that kind of thing. And it's also interesting that Jesus makes a reference to the same kind of setting in the gospel, where he talks about somebody filled with pride who goes up and sits at the place of honor at the head of the table. He says, don't do that, because they may have to call you and tell you to go sit at the end of the table, because somebody greater than you is going to take that seat, you know. So don't assume your own greatness. And so it's all part of good manners and stuff. So remember that a greedy eye is a bad thing. What has been created more greedy than the eye? Therefore, it sheds tears from every face. Do not reach out your hand for everything you see. And do not crowd your neighbor at the dish. Judge your neighbor's feelings by your own, and in every manner be thoughtful. Eat like a human being who is with what is set before you. And do not chew greedily, lest you be hated. Anybody see the movie The Seven Brides for Seven Brothers?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That was 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I still have that on my computer. I watch it at least once a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mary Beth loves that movie. But after she comes to live with them, if you remember, she has this big dinner, and they sit down to eat dinner. All of a sudden, they're reaching for stuff, and she whacks them on the hand with the spoon and says, stop acting like that. That's exactly what he's talking about right here. You know, don't reach out your hand for everything you see. You know, just have good manners. Control yourself. Plenty to eat. You're going to get all you want. Just control yourself. And then verse 17, it says, be the first to stop eating for the sake of good manners, and do not be insatiable, lest you give offense. If you are seated among many persons, do not reach out your hand before they do. How ample a little is for a well-disciplined man. He does not breathe heavily upon his bed. So he's saying if you eat too much and you get fat, it's hard to sleep at night because you can't breathe. You got an 80-pound gut pushing down on you. You can't breathe.
You have sleep apnea. Yeah.
Yes. Healthy sleep depends on moderate eating. He rises early and feels fit. The distress of sleeplessness and of nausea and colic are with the glutton. If you are overstuffed with food, get up in the middle of the meal and you will have relief.
Oh, dear.
Listen to me, my son, and do not disregard me. In the end, you will appreciate my words. In all your work, be industrious, and no sickness will overtake you. Men will praise the one who is liberal with food, and their testimony to his excellence is trustworthy. The city will complain of the one who is niggardly with food, and their testimony to his niggardliness is accurate. That just means stinginess.
My book says miserliness.
Yeah, just miserly, stingily. Those are all words that mean the same thing. Do not aim to be valiant over wine, for wine has just destroyed many. Fire and water prove the temper of steel, so wine tests hearts in the strife of the proud. Wine is life to men, if you drink it in moderation. What is life to a man who is without wine? It has been created to make men glad. Wine drunk in season and temperately is rejoicing of heart and gladness of soul. Wine drunk to excess is bitterness of soul, with provocation and stumbling. Drunkenness increases the anger of a fool to his injury, reducing his strength and adding wounds. Do not reprove your neighbor at a banquet of wine, and do not despise him in his merrymaking. Speak no word of reproach to him, and do not afflict him by making demands of him. A couple of different times he talks about a banquet of wine. I've never been to a banquet of wine. I've been to a wine tasting, but I've never been to a banquet of wine. Usually wine is something that accompanies a banquet.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting way of putting it there. So that brings us to chapter 32, which continues with the same thing. If they make you master of the feast, do not exalt yourself. Be among them as one of them. Take good care of them, and then be seated. when you have fulfilled your duties, take your place, that you may be merry on their account and receive a wreath for your excellent leadership. When I read that first section there, I was reminded of what they describe as the duty of the Pope. He's the servant of the servants of God.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the primary servant of everybody else. Mm. And that's kind of what he's saying right here.
Mm.
Take good care of them and then be seated. When you have fulfilled your duties, then take your place. Then in verse 4, and this session reminded me of what we talked about before, but Jesus says, don't sit at the first place of honor because you might have to move. Just speak, you who are older, for it is fitting that you should, but with accurate knowledge, and do not interrupt the music. Where there is entertainment, do not pour out talk. Do not display your cleverness out of season. A ruby seal in a setting of gold is a concert of music at a banquet of wine. A seal of emerald in a rich setting of gold is the melody of music with good wine. Interesting. Then he continues, speak, young man, if there is need of you, but no more than twice, and only if asked. Speak concisely, say much in few words. Be as one who knows and yet holds his tongue. Among the great, do not act as their equal. And when another is speaking, do not babble. Lightning speeds before the thunder, and approval precedes a modest man. Leave in good time and do not be the last. Go home quickly and do not linger. Amuse yourself there and do what you have in mind, but do not sin through proud speech. And for these things, bless him who has made you and satisfies you with his good gifts. So be satisfied with what you have and recognize that all the good gifts you have actually come from God. And that ends part 3. We now get into part 4. We got a total of 5 parts to the book of Sirach. We now get into part 4. The title is The Fullness of Wisdom is Fear of the Lord. So he's going back to the idea of fear of the Lord that he introduced before. He's going to go into it in more detail, beginning with this section here. And the introduction says, fear of the Lord. He's got a note here. It says, 32:14, which is where this begins, all the way through 42:14. So that's 10 chapters. These chapters make up the fourth part of the book. And here, too, we can see an introductory section dealing with fear of the Lord and divine wisdom, which has created a wonderful diversity in things, and then a section dealing with practical applications to do with different sorts of persons and things. The diversity that is part of their nature needs to be respected. And then 32:14 through 33:17, that's the doctrinal introduction here. It says, in this doctrinal introduction, Ben Sirach keeps to his plan of dealing with his main points systematically. He has now reached the point where he will examine in more detail something he pointed out at the start, namely that fear of the Lord is wisdom and learning. He said that in chapter 1, verse 27. Or to put it another way, keeping to the law, to the rules that the Creator himself has inbuilt into things, must be motivated by the basic principle of reverence for God and acknowledgement of his goodness. That is what fear of the Lord really means. That is the path of wisdom and happiness.
Reverence for God in what?
Reverence for God and acknowledgement of his goodness. So he's saying you says, keep the law, but not just because it's the law, but because you have reverence for God and are moved by what he defines as fear of the Lord, which is a desire to always show respect for God and never want to do anything to offend him and commit sin. Reverence for God and acknowledgement of his goodness. That is what fear of the Lord really means. That is the path to wisdom and happiness. Ben Sirach has much to say about the role of fear of the Lord in a person's growth and wisdom. He draws our attention to the wonderful diversity in the works of the Lord, and he ends up on an autobiographical note, unusual in the Old Testament. And that's in 33, verses 16 through 18. We'll get to that. He who fears the Lord is not proud, nor does he consider himself equipped to discover all truth or the best line of action in every situation. Rather, he is sensible enough to listen to what others have to say, and he seeks the advice of prudent people to discern what God's will for him is. By the way, St. Francis de Sales has a wonderful little book called The Will of God, Discerning the Will of God. And it's not a very big book. It's kind of a small book, but it's very good. So if you want to do that, it's one of our things. We can do that too. It's really good.
It
says, therefore, St. Gregory the Great says that empty-headed people postpone the right time to do a good deed and lose sight of its value. Often they fall into evil because they fail to see what is good. They do not take into consideration why or how they should act, although normally they recognize when they have acted in the wrong. The words of Solomon speak to them as if they were his first audience. My son, do not act without first taking advice. In that way, you will never have to repent for your deeds. So we begin with part four. Fear of the Lord and faithfulness to the law. He who fears the Lord will accept his discipline, and those who rise early to seek him will find favor. So what's he really saying here? Seek first the Lord before anything else. Be that your first thing. When you rise early, seek him. Whereas when you get up in the morning, say prayer first before you do anything else. He who seeks the law will be filled with it, but the hypocrite will stumble at it. There's a note here on that line where it says, but the hypocrite will stumble at it. The meaning of this line is uncertain. There are a lot of different ways people have interpreted that line. There's no clear certainty to it. But we're going to see that same phrase a little further on here. Those who fear the Lord will form true judgments, and like a light, they will kindle righteous deeds. A sinful man will shun reproof and will find a decision according to his liking. Isn't that what happened, why we have 30,000 different
religions,
denominations in this country? You know? So they want to find a decision according to their own liking. Mm-hmm. They don't like what they hear the preacher say, so they leave and start their own church. Mm-hmm. And now we've got 30,000 different denominations of Protestantism just in the United States alone. It's always people wanting to get their... And when they hire somebody who can tell them what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's just like a self-fulfilling prophecy kind of a thing. Or what a circular firing squad, sometimes they call it. A man of judgment will not overlook an idea, and an insolent and proud man will not cower in fear. Do nothing without deliberation, and when you have acted, do not regret it. Do not go on a path full of hazards, and do not stumble over stony ground. Do not be overconfident on a smooth way. There's an alternate translation here. Instead of a smooth way, an alternate translation is an unexplored way. to not be overconfident on an unexplored way. Mm-hmm. And give good heed to your paths. And there's some add a phrase to that. Give good heed to your paths and beware of your children. Depends on how you've raised them, right? Because he says if you don't beat the heck out of your kids, you know, they'll turn out bad. Okay. Guard yourself in every act, for this is the keeping of the commandments. He who believes the law gives heed to the commandments, and he who trusts the Lord will not suffer loss. So put all your trust in God. Then we get into chapter 33, which begins the wise man. No evil will befall the man who fears the Lord, but in trial he will deliver him again and again. A wise man will not hate the law, but he who is hypocritical about it is like a boat in a storm. So here's that hypocritical thing again. And he's talking about it in more clarity here. If you're hypocritical about the law of God, you're like a boat in a storm. You're never going to have clear sailing. You're never going to have smooth sailing. A man of understanding will trust in the law. For him, the law is as dependable as an inquiry by means of Urim. You know what Urim is?
No.
Anybody know what Urim is?
No.
The Urim and the Thummim? Do you know what they are?
I don't think so.
They are two stones that were on the breastplate of the high priest. Mm-hmm. One was black and one was white.
Uh-huh.
And the tradition, and the Bible doesn't say much about them at all, but the inclination is that the high priest would use these stones to consult with God. Mm-hmm. And one would mean, yes, one was black, one was white. One would mean yes and one would mean no. But they're very silent in Scripture on how to use these. Now, Joseph Smith picked up on this. And when he wrote the Book of Mormon, he talks about the Urim and the Thummim and how he uses them, like he's got them and stuff like this, you know, to do stuff and everything. And because he doesn't know what he was talking about. You know, obviously.
Sounds like it could quickly devolve into say something satanic, or
it could easily do that. So the breastplate had 12 precious stones, or semi-precious stones, one for each of the tribes of Israel. Then they had this Urim and Thummim, and the high priest was supposed to somehow use those when he asks God for guidance. But there's no description of just what that is and how he does it at all. So they have a kind of mysterious connotation. There's a novel called The Alchemist. And in this novel, Melchizedek tells Santiago that he must only ask objective questions of the stones, because the stones, Urim and Thummim, because they can only tell him yes or no. He can't ask him to elaborate. Can't ask him to elaborate. So the stones talk to him. That's in that novel.
Yeah.
That's not in Scripture.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like that ball.
And if you look at the meaning of Urim, it means lights or fires. And the stones were the Urim and the Thummim, and they're of an unknown origin. So if you look up in Scripture about them, you won't find much. You won't not find much.
Could it be from a pagan?
No, I don't think so, because they're part of the breastplate.
Okay.
But I think there's a reference to them in
1 Samuel 14:41 and 28:6 and Exodus 28:30 and Leviticus 8:8.
Yeah. Leviticus is the manual for the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have the whole breastplate and everything there. Yeah. He says, prepare what you say, and thus you will be heard. Bind together your instruction and make your answer. The heart of a fool is like a cartwheel, and his thoughts like a turning axle. A stallion is like a mocking friend. He neighs unto everyone who sits on him. The next section begins discerning good and evil. We're about at the end of our time, right. So mm-hmm. I'm going to stop here and pick up discerning good and evil, verse 7, with our next session here. Anybody have any thoughts before we close for the day? Okay. Well, we shall see you next week. Have a great week.
You too.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
Have a blessed week.
Blessed week.
Thank you. Don't forget Father Smith's birthday is Wednesday.
Yes. Oh, is that right?
Yes, 24th.
Yeah, 24th.
It's his birthday.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we shall see you. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Are any of you familiar with a ministry out of Alabama that priests are involved in, and they travel to enthrone people's homes to this Immaculate Heart of Mary and Sacred Heart of Jesus? It's called an alliance of.
I read somewhere in my mind that about this,
yeah.
About this, but I don't know too much. I did read an article.
Is it connected with that, yes. Medjugorje area of Alabama? Yeah. Alabama, did you say?
It's Alabama. Yeah. But they travel around, and they're not under like one diocese.
Right.
They go, I don't know, are they under Rome?